Dr. Philip Goff is a lecturer in philosophy at the University of Liverpool, specialising in philosophy of mind. In this interview and discussion, he addresses some of the philosophical problems behind the definitions of consciousness, materialism, and physicalism. Essentially, when we talk about consciousness, philosophy of mind, and its overlap perhaps with neuroscience, the first basic point we need is, what is a mind?
I suppose there are two different ways of defining mentality in a kind of philosophically interesting way. One in terms of thought and one in terms of consciousness. And it's quite interesting actually that in 20th century Anglo-American philosophy of mind, thought and consciousness were treated as completely different things to be accounted for in very different ways. And you can see this, for example, in many of the dominant theories of thought in the 20th century, for example, by Jerry Fodor or Donald Davidson, they had absolutely nothing to say about consciousness. So you can see that they just thought, you know, we can talk about thought without saying anything about consciousness. Whereas in the 21st century, there's a lot, many philosophers kind of railing against it and saying, well, now hold on, it's these two things aren't completely separate, that you can't give a theory of thought without talking about consciousness, because perhaps thought just is a kind of consciousness or is grounded in a certain kind of conscious experience. So there's controversy about whether thought and consciousness are independent of each other or whether they're closely related. But nonetheless, I suppose there are these two starting points. So maybe I should just explain to you how these things are defined. So again, I would follow Thomas Nagel, the standard definition of consciousness, that according to which a thing is conscious if there's something that it's like to be it. So there's something that it's like for a rabbit to be cold or to be kicked or to have a knife stuck in it. In contrast, there's nothing that it's like, or so we ordinarily suppose, for a table to be cold or to be kicked or to have a knife shoved in it. So there's nothing that it's like from the inside, as it were, to be a table. And so we mark this difference by saying that the rabbit, but not the table, is conscious. So it's important to note that consciousness on this standard philosophical definition does not involve anything kind of cognitively sophisticated of the kind you might be reluctant to ascribe to non-human animals. So I think this contrasts sometimes the way the word's used outside of philosophy or just in general parlance, in common parlance. It's sometimes meant to mean something kind of sophisticated, like maybe self-consciousness or awareness of self. That's not generally how philosophers use it. They just use it to mean any kind of inner experience, inner life. So that's how I tend to use the word consciousness. Thought. Thoughts are mental states that involve propositions in some sense. So propositions are things expressed by that clauses. So things like that London is the capital of England, that it's a sunny day, that I will die soon. These are propositions. So mental thoughts are mental states that involve propositions. So for example, believing that London is the capital of England, hoping that it's a sunny day, fearing that I'm going to die soon. So these are thoughts. So I suppose they're the two standard ways of starting to think about mentality as consciousness, having some kind of inner life or inner experience, or thought, mental state that involve propositions. And I suppose these are philosophically interesting because philosophers have found it difficult to incorporate these two aspects of mentality in our kind of standard scientific picture of the world, so sort of philosophical interest.
If we talk about a basic conscious experience, that may be anything just that involves a basic sensational phenomenon. So it may not necessarily have to be with an inner state. I don't know how you feel about that. For example, we'd all know what it's like to be human. We probably wouldn't all know what it's like to be a bat, because obviously they don't have advanced cognitive experiences and processes like we do. But from what you've just elaborated on there, that any kind of conscious experience basically has to be a state that it's like to be something. So what it's like to be a rabbit or a bat. And then thought on the other side, because it deals with these statements of propositions, are more likely to be tied in with a general analysis, logic and rationality. For example, we couldn't expect a rabbit or a bat to have logical propositions to the state that human consciousness has. How do you feel about this? What would you say in this area?
Yeah, that sounds about right. So so the standard definition of consciousness is just any kind of inner life and experience. So it's pretty uncontroversial that rabbits have consciousness, although Descartes thought they were just mechanisms, famously. But I guess most of us think rabbits have inner experience of some kind. And as you said, this standard definition comes from a very famous paper of Thomas Nagel, What's It Like to Be a Bat?, where he discusses if we can understand the inner life of a bat, because it has such a different way of experiencing the world to us, as it echolocates primary, is its primary way of getting around the world, which is something which he supposes must involve a kind of inner experience we can't really relate to. Whereas it's much less obvious, at least, put it that way, that, as you say, rabbits or bats have thought. This is something much more cognitively sophisticated, something linked to propositions, reasoning. I mean, some people think we should say that animals have thought, or maybe that they have proto-thought in some sense, something on the way to thought. But yeah, it's much less obvious. But as I say, the connection between thought and consciousness is contentious. So I'm inclined to the view, people who sometimes talk about phenomenal intentionality, rather technical term, I'm inclined to the view that thought of this kind of propositional kind just is a very sophisticated kind of consciousness. So I'm inclined to go, but that's a philosophically controversial view. So I guess still probably the orthodox view is that we can distinguish these two elements and treat them theoretically in very different ways.
I like the way you've summed it up with a proto-thought, because this, to a certain extent, nicely leads into the next question that I want to pose to you, which is a lot of people today do think that human cognition and thought is just this advanced form of conscious experience, both internally and externally, in terms of how we analyze our world around us. So, okay, some animals are conscious, even apes are very, very highly cognitive in terms of general basic problems. Obviously, they haven't got functions for languaging, but they're still very advanced as compared to bats. And this kind of brings it into the question of, if we have a mind and consciousness, and sometimes we can put them together, or sometimes we can separate them, and perhaps our thinking process is just an advanced form of consciousness as opposed to other animals, then what can be said philosophically of the role of the brain in this? Because animals have brains, but then they don't have consciousness like us, but we have the largest and most complex brain. So how would you address the area of brain and its relation to mind and consciousness?
I suppose I am strongly inclined to the view that what goes on inside our skulls ultimately accounts for thought and consciousness in humans and in other animals. I'm inclined to do without the hypothesis of souls, for example, think it is just a matter of goings on in our brains. But I would want to qualify that instantly. So let me say a bit more to make my view clearer, that I'm strongly of the view that we're not going to really make progress accounting for consciousness just from doing more neuroscience. Because I think, you know, what we get from neuroscience ultimately are correlations between brain states and conscious states. The neuroscience can tell us sophisticated information about which brain states go with which conscious states. So, you know, maybe looking inside our heads, brain scientists might discover that, you know, the feeling of pain always goes with brain state X, right? You know, so every time people are in brain state X, they feel pain, and vice versa. Whenever they feel pain, they're in brain state X. These two always go together. I mean, I'm sort of ludicrously oversimplifying, but I think this is the kind of information we get from brain science about the correlations between brain states and conscious states. But I think merely this kind of information about correlations isn't yet a complete theory of consciousness. What we want for a complete theory of consciousness is to explain those correlations, right? You know, why is it that the feeling of pain always goes with brain state X and vice versa? And it's only when we've got that explanation of correlations that we have a complete theory of consciousness. So I suppose, and this is the more kind of philosophical aspect of the project. So I suppose I'm pitting myself against, I mean, there are some philosophers or scientists who think that really to make progress on consciousness, we really need to just just do more brain science or more theorizing that's closely connected to empirical and scientific investigation. People like Daniel Dennett, George Ray, and they might put across the kind of view that if people like me who think we need to do something else other than just neuroscience might be branded as kind of anti-science or something, and, you know, grouped along with, you know, people who deny climate change or believe in magic or something. But I think this relies on a kind of oversimplistic conception of science, right? As though science is always a matter of just kind of doing your experiments and reading off the data, and that's the end of it. Whereas I think certainly at the more theoretical end of science, there's plenty of scope for progress being made by, for example, conceptual innovation, kind of coming up with new ways of thinking about the world, or deep thinking about the nature of possibility. So my favorite example, if you think of Einstein coming up with special relativity in 1905, you know, he wasn't going out doing experiments. He was spending a lot of time thinking about what it's like, what it would be like to ride on a beam of light. You know, would that be possible to go at the same speed as light, and what would follow from that? Or, you know, with general relativity later on, there's an incredible conceptual innovation. So I'm of the view that really, if we're to make progress on consciousness, it is ultimately, I think, about what's going on in the brain. But we're not going to really get there by just doing more. I mean, I don't want to underrate the importance of brain science and empirical investigation of the brain, but I don't think in and of itself that's going to do it. I think we're going to need conceptual innovation. We're going to need to radically rethink our ordinary ways of thinking about the world if we're going to really find a place for consciousness. So I suppose, although I am, ultimately I think we're going to explain consciousness in terms of what goes on in our brain, I don't think just doing more neuroscience is going to do the trick.
That's very much a contemporary concern for both philosophers and neuroscience in this field. So, for example, clearly neuroscientists only have correlations, and anyone that studies 101 philosophy of science or general scientific practice knows that correlation obviously isn't causation explanation. Obviously, your demand for having why it is that brain state X causes a phenomenon Y obviously needs an additional explanation. And it's very interesting because Sue Blackmore in this area as well was saying that we need to move on beyond this and have a different kind of conceptual innovation around what the mind is, because sometimes when we have to face it against neuroscience, we either fall into the standard Cartesian dualism or even a materialist dualism. That's something that Dennett's written about, how the mind, after we do all this neuroscience, people still think that the mind is somehow, the substance of the mind is produced separately from the brain, when really not only are they the same thing materially, but conceptually we have to move beyond just having brain and mind and combine them as one. Obviously, Einstein, with how he came up with a new definition of what space-time actually is, would be very much needed in this area, and very clearly there expressed some of the philosophical issues behind a study of the mind and its relation to neuroscience. Are there any more that we should take on board right now? I mean, that the issue with the hard problem was quite pivotal a few years ago. I've seen lately that not so many people taking that on board as they first, for example, Hameroff and Penrose and quantum consciousness is basically just filling in gaps with mystery and void. Some think the issue of internal conscious experience and qualia, you don't know what it's like when Tony sees red because only Tony knows what it's like when he sees red. That's also a bit problematic. What are the fundamental philosophical issues in this area? If you could explain some of those more.
Yeah, maybe I could talk a little about the view I favour. And seeing as it's into what you've said there about Dennett and Blackmore, maybe I could contrast the kind of conceptual innovation I think we need in contrast to the kind of conceptual innovation they think we need. So, I mean, as I understand them, I think Dennett and Susan Blackmore think we need to rethink our understanding of consciousness to solve the mind-body problem. Whereas I'm more inclined to think, no, what we need is to rethink our understanding of a physical world, right? So maybe you could put it this way. So I'm attracted to a view known as Russellian monism. And it's called Russellian monism because of the influence of Bertrand Russell in shaping this view in the 1920s. It's kind of old view, and Eddington had some similar thoughts. But it's sort of been lost, I think, for much of the 20th century. And at the moment, it's enjoying a kind of renaissance. But the starting point, I think, for the Rossellian monist, I think to understand the view, you have to sort of see things in the way they in the way they think about things. So I think the starting point is this. I think most people think about the mind-body problem like this, and I think Dennett and Blackmore would think about the mind-body problem like this. We know so much about the physical world now from the physical sciences, right? It's telling us this rich information. Maybe it's not perfect yet, but it's on its way to a complete picture of the physical world we live in. But then there's this mystery, consciousness. No, this is something we don't understand, and we need to kind of rethink it. We need to understand how we can think about consciousness to fit it into that world we get from the physical sciences. So I think that gets things the wrong way around. I think the thing we understand most of all is consciousness, just by being conscious. So just by feeling pain, experiencing emotions, thinking thoughts, I think we understand a hell of a lot about the nature of these conscious states just by being in them. We know what they're like just by being in them. So I think consciousness is the one thing we understand best of all. It's not a mystery at all. I think it's the rest of the physical world that we're less clued up on. Now you might say, well, hold on, don't we have this rich body of information from the physical sciences? And here's where you get to what I think was Bertrand Russell's central insight. And that is that when you reflect upon the kind of information we get about the physical world from the physical sciences, you find actually it's just telling us about what things do, not how they are in and of themselves. So think about what physics tells us about an electron. The physics tells us, for example, an electron has mass and charge. But physics characterizes mass and charge just in terms of what they dispose a thing with them to do, just in terms of how things behave. So for example, you know, things with mass attract other things with mass, that's gravity, and things with mass resist acceleration. The more mass something has, the more it resists acceleration. This is just a matter of what things do, how they behave. To turn to charge, things with opposite charges attract, things with like charges repel. So this is all mass and charge is characterized in terms of what things do. So for all its virtues, physics is really just telling us about how things behave. It's telling us what electrons do. It's not telling us what they're like in and of themselves. So I think in the public imagination, we have this idea that, you know, physics is giving us more and more this complete picture of reality. And I think that's completely wrong. I think the reason physics has been so successful from Galileo onwards is that natural sciences stopped trying to give us a complete picture of reality, and they just focused on describing the causal structure of reality. They just focused on describing what things do, how they behave. So that's the starting point. That's how I think about things. The one thing we really understand its nature in and of itself, independently of how it behaves, is consciousness. Everything else, physical science tells us about what it does, how it's disposed to behave, but it doesn't tell us anything about its nature independently of how it behaves. It doesn't tell us how it is in and of itself. So that's my general starting point. And then coming back to the mind-body problem, right? So let's think about how does the Rossellian monist think about the mind-body problem? For the Rossellian monist, brain science, for all its virtues, it's really just telling us about what brains do or about what the constituents of brains do. It doesn't tell us what brains are in and of themselves. You know, what is the intrinsic nature of a brain or a neuron? So what is the intrinsic nature of a brain or a neuron? So neuroscience leaves us in the dark about that. What does the Rossellian monist say about the intrinsic nature of a brain? The Rossellian monist says a brain is constituted of consciousness itself or something continuous with consciousness. So what you end up with is a kind of mind-brain identity, right? You know, the mind just is the brain. Mental states are brain states. But it's very different from a standard physicalist materialist identity theory in the sense that there's a certain priority given to the mental description. So according to Rossellian monist, you don't know what a brain is until you understand it in mental terms, okay? So David Chalmers has a good sentence on The View. He says it captures the spirit. Sorry, it captures the letter of materialism, but the spirit of anti-materialism. So it gets the letter of materialism because it's a sort of mind-brain identity, right? The mind is the brain, mental states are brain states. But it captures the spirit of anti-materialism because it gives this kind of priority to the mental side of the identity. You know, the nature of the brain is constituted by consciousness. So this is a kind of very, very different kind of way of thinking about these matters than you get from Dennett or Blackburn. So I guess Dennett and Blackburn say, we understand the physical world, we need to rethink consciousness. I, as a Russellian monist, go the other way around. I say, no, we really understand consciousness, we need to rethink the physical world. So I suppose these are two sides of the debate.
I've got two points that I want to clear up here, just for some clarification. So the way you've been describing aspects of Russellian monism, that we can't understand any phenomena that we observe in the physical natural world innately or intrinsically of itself apart from operational definition. So an atom is only how we define it here, and then we observe its behavior, and we from that we find patterns of complexity that we can then use for prediction. The same would occur with any other material definition in the scientific practice, such as, okay, we've got a neuron here, we define the neuron as this material substance here and it does this. Is this essentially alluding to a Kantian aspect that we can never really know the world in and of itself?
Yeah, that sounds about right, actually. And you know, a lot of physicalists have held something like this view. So I mean, David Lewis, who was a very hardcore physicalist, but in one of his final papers published posthumously, he defended a view called Ramsian humility, and the title is a play on another paper called Kantian humility. And really defending this view that goes back to Kant, that we don't really understand the intrinsic, that empirically we can't understand how things are in and of themselves. Yeah, so science tells us what electrons do, but they don't tell us how electrons are in and of themselves. So yeah, this view is certainly close. I mean, I'm no Kant scholar, so there's debate about, I mean, Ray Langton. So Ray, the phrase Kantian humility comes from Ray Langton, who has a book defending this kind of interpretation of Kant. I'm not qualified to say how good an interpretation of Kant that is, but that's the kind of view we're talking about. But this is very useful information. I don't want for a second to underrate the importance of the physical sciences. You know, rich information about what things do enables us to, you know, build lasers and put people on the moon and cure disease. You know, it's incredibly useful, complex, rich understanding of what things do. But I think that what's happened in the latter half of the 20th century, we've got so impressed by what science has enabled us to do, what physical science has enabled us to do with technology, that we thought, oh my God, it's giving us a complete picture of everything, you know? But I think that's the wrong thing. I think that the reason it's been so successful is because, well, as I say, from the scientific revolution onwards, we stopped trying to capture things as they are in themselves. And we just thought, let's just describe what things do. And I think, you know, if you look at Galileo, he's quite explicit about this, and, you know, in this his kind of philosophical remarks. So yeah, but yeah, I think it's you're right to make that connection to a kind of Kantian view.
There's a lot to be said for that Kantian view, because essentially it goes to what fundamentally underpins truth and reality. Do we really ever know epistemologically what these essences are, and how, obviously, can we ever get a real stab at what ontologically exists, or essentially is ontology another construct of the mind, or we're stuck on this prison of condition? I'm a big fan of Kantian in that respect. Unfortunately, as you say, in today's world, people have just gotten so inevitably carried away by the way we execute this as opposed to the philosophical underpinnings from it. But that's a separate issue for another conversation. My second point that I wanted to pick up from you there, which was how you were describing and addressing the point that how we need to think of conscious experience is something almost primal and first, without any kind of mental definitions of anything else on top. And it also alluded to the David Chalmers quote there. How much license are you willing to grant the possibility that it doesn't necessarily have to be materialism then consciousness, but perhaps consciousness and then aspects of materialism? I.e., I'm asking you, do you believe that consciousness could be an irreducible ontological fact in itself?
Yeah, I mean, the word materialism is a bit tricky to define. Some people do. But I certainly am very attracted to the view that consciousness or something continuous with consciousness is fundamental and ubiquitous in nature. So this is the view, panpsychism or chronopsychism. So that is certainly a view I'm very attracted to. And people find that a strange view, but I think once you think about things in the way I've been trying to describe, it becomes an awful lot more plausible. So, you know, if you start from the starting point that the one thing we really understand about the intrinsic nature of the world is consciousness, right? That's all we really understand. So we know from the inside that brains are conscious and they involve consciousness in their essential nature. Everything else we're kind of in the dark about. I mean, we know from natural science there's rich information about what it does, about its causal structure, but we don't know about its intrinsic nature. So it's sort of like we've got this big picture that's mostly in black and white, and then the brains are coloured in with consciousness, right? The rest is just left black and white. So our task as metaphysicians, that is people who want a complete picture of reality, is we have to colour in the rest of the picture, right? We know that brains are coloured in with consciousness, but the rest of the picture's blank. We need to colour in its intrinsic nature. That's my starting point. And then once you're in that starting point, the most simple, parsimonious, theoretically satisfying thing to do is to say, well, the most likely hypothesis is that the intrinsic nature of all the other stuff is continuous with consciousness, with continuous with what I know about from the case of my own brain. That's just, you know, that might not be true. We don't know. You know, we've got to just speculate. But it's the simplest, most parsimonious, economical, theoretically satisfying explanation. So that's why I give a lot of weight to it. And you know, so I mean, to my mind, it's panpsychism is the view most likely to be true of consciousness. You know, you said material. Some people, so Galen Strawson is a panpsychist. He calls himself a physicalist as well. So he would say, yeah, I'm a physicalist, I'm a panpsychist. And I think these things are terminological. It just depends how you define physicalism. I prefer myself to define physicalism just to define the view such that if you think consciousness is fundamental, you're not a physicalist. I just prefer to define physicalism like that because I think that just as a pragmatic matter, I think the debates line up better. So I would say, given that definition, I'm not a physicalist. But yeah, so that's certainly the view I think is most likely to be true, some form of panpsychism, that consciousness or something continuous with consciousness is fundamental and ubiquitous in nature.
I was going to mention Galen Strawson. Very refreshing that you come up openly and philosophically defend panpsychism, that consciousness is perhaps something primary and irreducible. Very interesting. I don't know if you have read the book called Why the World Exists. It's by a guy who writes for the New York Times. He's also a philosopher. His name is, I can't think of it at the top of my head. But in it, he's got interviews with philosophers, cosmologists, theoretical physicists, biologists, etc. And even mystics from the Eastern tradition. And one of the interviews he has is with a professor of philosophy from Canada called John Leslie. He talks a lot about panpsychism as well. And the different, obviously the whole book is about why does anything exist at all. And it talks through these different options. And one of them, because I spoke to John Leslie about this as well, and it's very interesting, he gives like the five possible categories of why anything exists at all. And one of them is panpsychism, that there is just kind of irreducible consciousness in the first place. So yes, if I gather correctly, I know it's going to be a very watered down understanding of Galen Strawson, but he is a physicalist because to a certain extent he believes that physicalism can be derived from consciousness and not necessarily the other way around.
Me and Galen have very similar views. We just define the word physicalism in different ways, and he thinks of the physical as, you know, whatever this stuff is, whatever the stuff that physics talks about is. So if this, you know, if the stuff that physics talks about turns out to be fundamentally mental, well, you can still be a physicalist, because that's just his definition of the physical. It's just, you know, whatever this stuff that physics talks about is. Whereas I define physicalism, I define the physical such that if the stuff physics talks about turns out to be fundamentally mental, then physicalism is false. I mean, this is not a very interesting issue, really. It's just about, it's annoying that it has to take up time at all defining, but it's just, if we're going to do it's interesting actually that, you know, there's lots of philosophical debates about whether physicalism is true or not, but it's actually not very clear what physicalism actually means. So I prefer to define physicalism in that way because I think the debates line up nicer. But apart from that terminological difference, I think me and Galen have quite similar views. We do have a difference in our reasons for supporting panpsychism, though, which is a more interesting substantive issue. So, and Galen argues for panpsychism. He's got a quite traditional argument for panpsychism. He has this intuition that you can't possibly get consciousness from non-consciousness, right? He thinks, you know, that would be magic. That would be a miracle. You can't possibly get something that's conscious from stuff that's non-conscious. So he thinks consciousness must have been there all along. So, yeah, I'm ludicrously oversimplifying his argument, but that's roughly what Galen thinks. I don't share that intuition. I don't see that we have kind of a priori grounds for thinking there couldn't be. I certainly think we can't get consciousness from the kind of properties physics talks about. So in that sense, I'm an anti-physicalist. But I don't see why. I don't think we have any reason to rule out that there could be some really strange stuff that the universe is made of that's not consciousness, but is somehow intrinsically suited to constitute consciousness. So this is what is often referred to as proto-consciousness or proto-phenomenal properties. So I'm open to that view. The reason I'm a panpsychist is just because of theoretical elegance. I think when we're doing metaphysics or science, we need to go for the most theoretically elegant theory. And it seems to me that panpsychism looks to be the most simple, elegant, parsimonious view. And so that's why I'm very attracted to it. So I think, you know, the way I approach metaphysics is this. I think, you know, we've got two forms of evidence. One, consciousness, that this phenomenon we know about from the inside, we understand a lot about by being conscious. Two, the information we get from the natural sciences about the causal structure of the universe, about what things do. And then when we do metaphysics, what we do is we put these two things together. Information we know about consciousness from the inside, information we know about the physical world from the outside. We put them together and we try and come up with the most simple, theoretically satisfying hypothesis that we can. I sometimes call this analytic phenomenology. And I think panpsychism looks to be, on the face of it, there are problems with it that need to be dealt with, but looks on the face of it to be the most simple, theoretically satisfying hypothesis. And so that's why I give it a high amount of credence.
Thanks for that justification, Phil. Just one thing, if I could track him back now. When you were describing Brazilian monism and I was saying why I also agree with certain aspects of the Kantian understanding, if you were going to conjoin the two, of our understanding of what we can do with empirical investigation and how we then layer this with theoretical propositions that we can somehow test. Obviously, it's always going to be problematic of whether we can fully understand what is going on in terms of reality and what is truth, not more so because paradoxically it then becomes perhaps evident that terms such as truth and reality are also constructed. So it's kind of like a double whammy in that respect. One thing though that I would say about modern practitioners of pure naturalism, both in a scientific community and a philosophical community, is if we were to talk about how we work with definitions of what the atom is or the neuron is, and we just observe this regulative behavior and see what their causal mechanisms are. So as you were saying, and to a certain extent the Kantian approach would be like, yes, okay, we can have a causal explanation of X, but that doesn't tell us anything about what the causal property or the outcome X is intrinsically or innately in itself. I think to a certain extent, and a valid argument that could be said from detractors from that in both the scientific and the philosophical communities, that people are quite happy to openly admit that, but then that's not necessarily an issue because we could be stuck with this infinite regression all day long. So for example, if you look at theoretical physics and cosmology, why is it that inflationary cosmology produces the condensation from energy into matter? It's just the way it is. That's a causal regularity. We can't tell you about the intrinsic nature of that phenomenon. And it's also why is the second law of thermodynamics entropy, that chaos must increase? Why is it that a object like this, at the atom, behaves like this at miniature scales? So someone like Dennett, obviously not to speak for him or put words in his mouth or anything from that kind of side of the philosophical debate, but they're quite happy to be oh, well, yeah, we can't have any intrinsic understanding of what consciousness may be in and as itself, but the fact that we can at least explain to a certain extent what causes it, that's all we can have, and perhaps we should just be happy with that. How do you feel about this?
Right, very interesting. So I'd say two things. So firstly, I mean, I'd want to distinguish. Some people think, you know, hold what Leibniz's principle, the principle of sufficient reason. They hold, you know, for anything that happens, anything that exists, there must be an explanation of its existence. And this can get us into arguments for the existence of God as a first cause. Or that's not quite what I'm demanding. I mean, I'm happy to go along with Wittgenstein's point that, you know, explanations have to end somewhere. I'm not demanding it, you know. At some point, we're going to get to the brute level where, you know, that's just the end of the story. That's how things are. I'm not demanding, you know, complete explanations that, you know, in a way that's arguably going to lead to regress. My point is just that there must be more to how things are than what they do, right? As it were, things are beings, they're not doings, right? There must be more to what an electron is than what it does. Science only tells us what an electron does. So there must be more to the nature of an electron than science tells us about. That's my thought. Now, of course, you know, that doesn't denigrate the importance of the information we get about from science. And it doesn't mean that scientists have to worry about this, right? Scientists can get on with finding out this very important information about what electrons do or other constituents of the physical world. But it still seems to me we ought to appreciate the point that there must be more to what the electron is than what it does. So there must be more to what the physical sciences are telling us about it. Some people deny that, right? And, you know, I'm not meaning to, you know, there's a huge debate about, so causal essentialists, this is the philosophical view that that's just false, that beings are just doings. There's nothing more to what something is than what it does. And, you know, that's a view we should take seriously and a view we need to argue against. And, I mean, I suppose I have two problems with it. I mean, one view, I think it's incoherent, although it's quite difficult to demonstrate that. There's a big debate there. People like David Armstrong and John Hyle have tried to argue that it's incoherent. But also, I think the fact the existence of consciousness shows it, that it can't be true. I think consciousness, the nature of consciousness goes beyond what consciousness does. There's intrinsic nature to consciousness that can't be completely captured in causal terms. Oh, that you know, that position needs defending as well, which I've done at length. So I suppose from my perspective, I mean, I kind of see history, intellectual history, as divided into two great epochs, right? Before Galileo and after Galileo, right? So before Galileo, we tried to capture everything. We tried to get a complete picture of reality. Then from Galileo onwards, what we did, we said, no, that's too hard, right? Let's just focus on what things do. Let's focus on capturing the causal structure of reality. And that's gone really well, right? And for 400 or 500 years since then, since the scientific revolution, we've slowly developed this incredible body of information. But because it's only information about what things do, it's not a complete picture of the world. So I think what we need to do now, and this is very big picture, we need to move to a third epoch, a kind of post-Galilean epoch, where we take this rich and wonderful information about causal structure that we've got from science, but we try to bring consciousness back into it, and we try to get a complete picture of the physical world for the first time. And to my mind, when we do that, and we haven't really started doing that yet, when we do that, you know, metaphysics proper can begin. That is the project of trying to get a complete picture of the world. You know, so people say, you know, why hasn't philosophy and metaphysics established anything in thousands of years? You know, my answer would be it hasn't really started yet, you know. We haven't got to the point where we've got science, natural science, in a kind of relatively mature state, and then we try to bring consciousness back into it. And I think when we start doing that, that's when metaphysics proper will begin. You know, maybe it won't, maybe it'll get somewhere, maybe it won't. But, you know, we should give it a go.
In terms of causal essentialism there, I think you could tackle it both views head on. So for example, I think it could be justified that a property is all we need to know about it. It's something that it does, not what it is intrinsically of itself. So for example, we know what x-rays do, but we don't need to know what intrinsically an X-ray is. Some would collapse them two together, saying that what an X-ray does is what an X-ray is. Now, problematically with consciousness, I think very plausible view is the fact that we can't just look at consciousness as something that it just does. Instead, of we might just look at what consciousness is. Now, obviously, hardcore materialists, especially in the neuroscience area, would be that consciousness is what it is essentially what it does. And then obviously we're back into the circular arguments that you want to move beyond. And with this in mind, I just want to get what your future work and research is going to be in this area, because obviously you've alluded to some massive conceptual transformations that we need, both metaphysically and philosophically in general, when we study consciousness and the physical world around us. So if you could just take a few minutes to tell us what's on your research horizon coming up in the future, and what you think other factors should be included going forward studying philosophy of mind and consciousness.
Just to follow what we said about Lewis there, yeah, I mean, so Lewis's definition of pain, for example, is, you know, our concept of pain is someone is in pain if they have an inner state that plays a certain causal role that, you know, roughly negotiates between bodily damage and avoidance behavior. So that's just Lewis, that's our concept of pain. It's a concept of just what it does. You know, and that's a philosophical position that we should take seriously and argue against. But my starting point is argue against that view. So I suppose in terms of my philosophical project, I suppose it's divided into two. One half is arguing against standard forms of physicalism, like the David Lewis view, like the Daniel Dennett view, which is that consciousness can be just explained in kind of given a kind of conventional scientific explanation, that we don't need conceptual overhaul, we don't need radical conceptual innovation in order to make sense of it. So that's one half. That's, I suppose, the negative part of my project. And then the positive part of my project is actually doing that conceptual work. Actually, so I think in order to really find a place for consciousness in reality, we really need to completely rethink our understanding of reality. And I suppose it's that positive project that I'm also engaged on. And as I say, I find panpsychism or panpropsychism to be the most plausible ways of spelling out that project as things stand now. And there are problems, for example, the well-known combination problem with panpsychism. So as panpsychists, we've got to deal with that. But it looks, on the face of it, there don't seem to be any kind of knockdown objections to the view. There seem to be things we need to work on, things we need to work out. And it's quite exciting, actually. The last four summers, we've had four international conferences on panpsychism, and really getting down to the nuts and bolts of trying to make rigorous sense of this view. So it's not just a kind of vague but attractive view of the mind. It's, you know, really working out the nuts and bolts. So at the moment I'm working on a book basically doing those two things. So the first half, arguing against standard physicalism, David Lewis, Daniel Dennett view, and second half really doing this positive project of trying to work out a satisfactory form of panpsychism that can accommodate the reality of consciousness in a empirically satisfying, scientifically respectable picture of the world.